Det var en sanning.
Before we commence today's sermon then, let us all bring our palms together to make our veneration to the perfect one, the undefeated one, the unvanquished one, the infinitely compassionate one, he who is the fount of wisdom, the all-seeing, the all-knowing one. Reminding ourselves that it is in his footsteps today we follow to achieve liberation, that is for us. And as we do so, let us remind ourselves that this is not a mere mark of our respect towards the Buddha, but also a pledge of allegiance to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, which represent the truth, the path to our liberation, as well as the practice that we must all undertake by ourselves. It is to that we remain steadfast and uphold our values to help us get there. So with that in mind, let us now chant the Namaskara, following which we will seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem and observe the precepts, and we will then invite the countless sentient beings to join us and be amongst us, to witness this meritorious deed as it unfolds, and to listen to the teaching of the Great Master in the hope that they may also attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana as we are about to do.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Keeping steady on the path. Yes? Where's the evidence? Shall I ask your husbands? Can I ask your wives? I'm not going to ask the Buddha. The statue that you have at home, that is not who I'm going to ask. You know, a good Buddhist cannot be judged as to whether they are a good Buddhist or not by merely the fact that they wake up in the morning and they do their rituals and offer flowers and water and light the joss sticks, light the lamps and do their gatha, right? Maybe even observe the precepts. There's, you know, observing the precepts, there's two varieties of that. One is to say, as the Swaminarayan says, and repeat after him. That's also an observation. But then to actually observe through your practice, through your conduct. So one is very easy to do. Swaminarayan says, you repeat. How many times you've done that by now? Countless times. But then to be someone who actually observes the precept by virtue, by conduct, that's not as easy. It's easier said than done. Because when the mind has desires and the mind has defilements, it always pushes you out of your precepted precinct. It pushes you to do unvirtuous, unrighteous things, which sometimes you regret later on, but the best thing to do is to try and not have to fall into that pit in the first place. And that is what the Dhamma is here for. So if I really wanted to find out whether you were a good Buddhist, who should I ask? Not the Buddha, not the Buddha statue you have at home. I shall ask the people you spend your time with. That is who I should ask. I will ask them how you behave when they get angry. That's the test. You know, it's okay for them to be angry, but it's not okay for you to get angry, not okay for you to retaliate. Because it's you who's here, not them. Yeah? If they were here, then I'd be telling them off for getting angry, because they shouldn't either. But You are a good Buddhist if you can remain calm, serene, maintain your composure when people around you cause you adversity. Because Nibbana in one word is acceptance. To accept is Nibbana. Accept both good and bad. Truth be told, true realization of Nibbana is the realization that there is no such thing called good and bad. Everything's the same. Because who's the judge to decide whether something's good or bad? What's good for one person is bad for another, right? So then, is there such a thing called objectively good and objectively bad? There is no such thing. These are all subjective measures. What's good for you is bad for someone else. What's bad for them is good for you. And this is why people are always at odds with each other. So when you have to live in a household where two people are of differing opinions, what's good for one person is bad for another, then you have conflict. Unless at least one of them is able to accept. So, you know, if you have problems at home, for instance, or if you at least have had, maybe not anymore. Swami knows you think too highly of us, huh? Come on, he's a poet, eh? Take some credit. So, if you have conflicts at home, who do we point our finger at? Who should we be pointing our finger at? The only place you can fix. What's the point of pointing your finger at something you can't fix? That's a fool. If it's too hot and you point at the sun and say, that's the problem. No one but a fool would do that. Don't you think? And when it's raining, if you get wet and you point at the clouds and say, they're the ones at fault. Only a fool would do that. Because you can't change that. So if something can't be changed, then your job is to accept it. Accept it and bring your mind to a state where you're okay with everything. And absolutely anything. So, this is why I say that the best measure to figure out whether you are progressing on this path and whether the Dhamma is actually doing something for you is to ask the people around you, the people with whom you spend your day, be that at home, at the workplace, your neighbors, whether they still hear the quarrels from your side of the house, your children, how you deal with them when they do something mischievous. Because after all, if you haven't found peace within, then you've found nothing in the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha never came into this world to give us a lot of doctrine, to give us stuff to learn, stuff to remember, stuff to memorize. I mean, there was plenty of that even before his time. So we didn't need another teacher to come along and tell us a whole bunch of things to learn, right? So he was not a scholar in that regard. He was a philosopher who gave us a philosophy of life. Because our philosophies for life were broken. We have a broken philosophy. We always believe that happiness is to be found outside, elsewhere. We were on a pursuit for happiness. The pursuit of happiness is the very reason we are not happy, is what he taught us in a nutshell. Now hopefully you have begun to see the truth in those words through your own life and the transformation that the Dhamma is having on you. In a nutshell, that is what it is. The pursuit of happiness is the reason that you are not happy. So the day you realize that happiness is not something you need to go after, you stop your pursuit. And the moment you stop, you realize, I'm at peace. I'm happy. So what we are here to do is to try and achieve that state of mind. how you can stop looking for happiness. Doesn't sound very exciting, does it, that proposition? Because what are we used to? Why do you go to the theater? Why do you go to the drama? Why do you go to a concert? Why do you go to see your children perform at school? Why do you go shopping? Why do you go clubbing? No, don't go clubbing, Swami. All right, just saying, no judges here. I'm just saying, right? Why do you go traveling? Why do you go to adventure, all sorts of adventures, canoeing, cycling, mountain climbing, all these things. We do all these things because we believe that those adventures, those enterprises, those activities would bring us happiness. You have a fridge at home, don't you? What do you have in the fridge? Give me one word for what you have in the fridge. Happiness, yes. Your fridge is full of happiness, especially in the top shelf, right? Top drawer. This is where you stock your ice cream. And in the door you have your chocolates and your fizzy drinks, your puddings, your pies, your cakes. The reason that these things that you so-called mouth-watering is because you believe that they bring you happiness. Your brain, your mind rather, has been taught to think like that. This is your internal working. This is your philosophy for life. And I'm here to point out that there's a flaw with that, in thinking that these pursuits will bring you happiness. So I'm going to connect this conversation to what we spoke of last week, for those of you who are not here yesterday, not here at the monastery. We had a bit of a conversation about what we started off last Sunday, yesterday at the monastery. See these flowers, aren't they pretty? They're beautiful, aren't they? So you might use something like this at home to decorate. Because you like looking at them, don't you? So, I don't know whether I'm permitted to do this. Can I? This is pretty, isn't it? So when I hold this to you, where do you focus? The stem or the flower? The flower, why is that? Which is prettier? The flower is. Would you rather me hold it like this or like this? Which side is more beautiful? This side. So do you see, you're not happy with absolutely anything. There's a certain way that you prefer. So I can make you happy and I can make you unhappy. You have given me the power to do that. See? I can control your happiness. Why do you let me do that? I ask you. Right now you're not happy. If I did this, you'd be even unhappier. And then if I took this flower and started breaking these petals off, you wouldn't have that. You'd come and take it away from me and say, no, so I'm not saying if you can't appreciate the beauty of a flower, right, give it back. And this is why these flowers are pointing towards you. Come on, is this not an offering to me? These people... What are you people like? Do you see what they've done? Manu, Swaminas, have you seen what they've done? See, they pointed those flowers at them because they want to see the flowers. It's not an offering to me. Have a think about why you've done it that way. It's okay, right? But think about why it's like that. Why is it that you have that side pointing you, the flower pointing you, and not this way? Because you don't see the beauty of this side. Ah, it's for the camera. Aww. You're too kind. Yeah, I believe that. See, that was an insult to the people watching this on camera. You don't see the beauty of the flower of this side. You only see the beauty on this side. That means half of this world is ugly. The other half is pretty. Therefore, what that means by extension is that you're only happy half of the time. The other times, you're not happy. You have chosen to be like that, which is unfortunate. If you stop picking sides, you'd be happy all the time. I've given you this example of a game of cricket, a sport that we're all very fond of. When Sri Lanka plays another team, you can only enjoy half the game, right? When one of our batsmen scores runs, you're happy. But when he's struck out, you're unhappy. When there's a ball up in the air and it's going flying towards the boundary, you're happy. But if it falls just short of the boundary, you're unhappy. And if what's worse, if there's a fielder who catches it before the ball hits the ground, nothing could be worse than that. So technically, at the end of the game, you should be able to go back to the people who sold you the ticket and ask for half of your money back, right? Because you actually only enjoyed half the game. The other half, you didn't really enjoy, but they charged you full price. But if you didn't pick a side, seriously, think about this. If you hadn't picked a side, you'd have enjoyed every moment of that game. Every catch, every strike, every ball, every wicket, every run out. Yeah? And as well as every run. Do you not want that in your lives? Where you can enjoy every moment of beauty. But for that, you have to think outside the realms of what you are used to thinking. You're stuck in this box. This is our narrow-minded thinking. We pick sides, we are partisan. That is why we don't get to enjoy and experience every beauty there is in this world out there. The Arahant is someone who experiences the beauty of everything. But not in the way that you believe and you understand beauty. It's in a very different way. When everything's beautiful, then there is nothing to say something's more beautiful than something else. Now, gents, when you saw or set your eyes on the person that you thought you were going to get married to, or the person with whom you fell in love, right, many years ago maybe, there was a certain way that she presented herself to you. Maybe she had her makeup on, maybe she had her hair done a certain way, maybe she was dressed very elegantly, or maybe in a way that really you found very appealing. See, it was a whole package. Every bit of it was what you found attractive. Perhaps the way she wore her hair. So actually, you liked her, but she had to come a certain way. So much so that if she changed that way, you'd not have liked it. Therefore, once you made her yours, in a way, it's like say you said, okay, you, now we are going to live together, or you're my partner, you're the one who I'm going to live the rest of my life with, and you came to that agreement, then there were certain conditions that he or she had to fulfill. So then they were not free to change whatever aspect of them they wanted without your consent. Because there were so many boxes that had to be ticked. And each of those boxes, that the combination of all those was what you found attractive. Therefore, really what happened was she was free to make her own decisions before she met you. But then after she did, now those decisions were very restrained. You placed your constraints on all that. So what happened to her freedom? She lost it the moment she met you. And the same, vice versa. You lost your freedom the moment you met her. Because there was a way in which you had to be, the way in which you had to wear your hair, a way in which you had to paint your nails, lips, face, whatever, the way in which you had to talk. Now you see, is it not normal? Now, you see, before you get into a relationship, you can be very relaxed with everyone, right? So boys, girls, it makes no difference. Right? So it's totally fine for a girl to have a boy as a best friend. And, you know, embrace each other, hold hands, go on trips and so on, whatnot. But once they commit themselves to someone, or once they give a word to someone, say, you know, I'm going to be yours. Now, what happens to that freedom? You've got to let go of that now. You no longer have that freedom to hold hands, hug, embrace. I'm not saying in every situation, some situations it's more relaxed than others, but typically you lose that freedom to do that anymore. So the same experience, that experience of friendship can no longer be enjoyed. Why? Because it's not just you they wanted, but they wanted you in a certain way. There was a certain model into which you had to fit. This is what happens when you become victim to people's desires, wants, and needs. Actually, most of the time, we don't live our lives freely. We live our lives the way that someone else wants us to live. Ask yourself whether that is not true. You're not free to do whatever you want to do. I'm not saying let's do something like really wild and that would be unlawful. Even within the law, you're still not free to do whatever you want to do. And every time you build a relationship with someone, that freedom, what happens to it, is further constrained. Just ask yourself why that is. Why is it that when you have come into relationship with someone, the freedom to do whatever is restrained? It's because you now have to fit into this box that they give you. Because if you want that relationship to work, then you have to be the way that they want you to be. It's a give and take, isn't it? So actually, it's not right to say that they like you. That sentence is not complete. Help me complete that sentence. They like you if... dot, dot, dot. What are all these ifs? Why all these ifs? Think about this. Pretty much anyone and everyone who likes you, what? If. Can you deny me? Can you deny what I've just said? No. Think of any relationship you're in. Okay, ladies, if you're married, think about your spouses. Your husbands like you. I'll even go as far as saying loves you. They love you. Yes, yes, they love you. I'm sure they do. Right? Your husbands love you, but what's the magic word? Huh? Right? All at once? If. Yes, if. Another word would be provided. Huh? conditions. There's not a single lady in the house who can stand up and say, "No, Swami, no, sir, my husband likes me, loves me, no matter what." Really? I will give you some tests then. Don't you later come back and tell me, "Swami Nwansa, he left me, Swami Nwansa." So then to the husbands in the house, of those wives, I have this question then to ask you. Is it really your wife you love? Would you say that you unconditionally love her? You cannot say yes to that question. You do not love her unconditionally. You love her conditionally. Your love is conditioned. Meaning, it's not just her you love. You love her with a number of different conditions. Therefore, provided she comes with all these conditions satisfied, then you're okay with that, but not otherwise. So much so that if any of these conditions change, you will be quick to point them out to her. Huh? Why? How? When? Why did you do that? Who's that? Who's that sent texting you at this time of night? Ask yourself why. Is this the freedom that you wanted or your parents promised you when they married you off to that man? I mean, I could ask the same question from the husbands here. Is there a single husband who would stand up and say, "My wife loves me no matter what, Swami knows. I can drink all I like. I can party all I like. I can be with my friends all I like. Huh? I can watch sport all day if I wanted to. She doesn't mind whether I do the dishes or don't do the dishes. She loves me no matter what." Is there a single husband here who can stand up and say that? If so, come with me to the monastery. I have a job for you. And it comes in a uniform. See, the answer is no. I'm bursting your bubbles, aren't I? But let's face the facts. Let's not be fooled. Let's face the facts. Let's face the facts that nobody loves you naked. I mean metaphorically. You know what I mean by naked? Pure you. You just the way you are. No one likes you like that. No one loves you naked. No one likes you naked. They only want to see you dressed up. They want to see you with your makeup on. Again, metaphorically. They only want to see you with your hair done up. They only want to see you with your lipstick, with your eyeliners, with your eyeshadows. I still remember those things. I'm surprised. I'm surprised that I can still remember those things. They only love you with your manicures and your pedicures done. Again, metaphorically I speak. They only like you, they only love you if you speak a certain way and only with a certain number of people, not with everyone. There are certain words that have to be restrained to certain individuals. If you said those words with just about anybody, that relationship would not last. What I mean to say is, no one loves you naked. So who are you fooling? And why are you being fooled? Why do you think that the whole world accepts me just the way I am? Why do you think that your husband accepts you just the way you are? Why do you think that your wife accepts you just the way you are? Because I find sometimes people think that. And it's wrong. I just want you to open your eyes and accept the truth. It is wrong to think that your spouses accept you just the way you are. Because they don't, ladies and gentlemen. They don't. So don't fool yourselves. Only the Buddha accepts you just the way you are. See? Your husband only likes to see this side of you. He doesn't like to see this side of you. So if he ever sees this side of you, he will soon enough prompt you, remind you, insist that you do yourself up so that you look like this. This is the way you live your life then. Because nature will always take you back to this. So it's life is an endless struggle to try and put this face in front of the world. This is what you do all your life. Try and keep this face. And how can you call that happiness then? Can I ask you a question then? Do you think your husband's happy with you? Do you think your wife is happy with you? No one's happy with anyone. And that is because everyone expects something from you. Anyone who expects cannot be happy. Because wherever there's an expectation that that expectation will be fulfilled. And therefore, along with that fear that such expectations will go unfulfilled, there's always a fear that this will turn this way. There's a worry. And the moment it does, then comes sorrow and grief. So you see, tanha jayati soko, tanha jayati bhaya. How can the mind be free of both of these? It's always in one state or the other. See, when you face this side, when you're looking this way, to the people who claim to like you and to love you, they're in a state of fear. They're afraid that you might turn the other side. Otherwise, why does he always check your phone? Why does he ask you, who was it that you were speaking with last night? Why? Think about it. So he's not happy. And the thing is, you can't make him happy either. Because happiness is not something that you can make. What did I say just the moment I began this sermon? The pursuit of happiness is the reason people are not happy. To try and make someone happy is the last thing that you can do. Because happiness is not something that you can make. If ever you try to make happiness, you end up making unhappiness. This is why life is never content. That is why you can never find content in life. Contentment in life. So when you're facing this way, he or she is in fear that at some point this might turn around. And when it does, they are in sorrow and grief, and they come and begging you, please, 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 can you turn the other way? And then you do. And now they're again scared that you might again go back to the other way. So, how can you find happiness then in a conditioned relationship? How can you find happiness in a conditioned entity? In a conditioned setup, how can there ever be happiness? Because happiness has to be unconditioned. Whatever is conditioned has to be sustained, maintained. You have to keep putting effort. Now let's link this conversation to where we stopped last week. So this is a segue to last week's conversation. We are here to understand how our minds work and why our minds work that way. Right? I'm not here to teach you how to change the world. I'm here to help you figure out what's going on in your world. Your world happens up here. All this turmoil is going on up there. fear, grief, anger, jealousy, greed, lust, disappointment, all these things, they torment you because they're homemade. That's what they are. They're all homemade. You ask yourselves whether this is not true. Just assume you get a phone call. Say it's after 10. Okay, so you're the wife of the house. You should get a phone call on your husband's phone. Then you think, you know, why not? I'm only the wife, so it's okay for me to answer his phone. So you pick up the phone and it's from a number that's not saved. Oh, let's even better. It's saved in a male's name. Okay, so it's saved in a gent's name. You answer, assuming that it must be one of his male friends. And then it's a lady. Yes. And then they speak very, like, you know, they're very close friends. And say, oh, I didn't expect you'd pick up at this time. Assuming that it's your husband on the phone. And you're like, excuse me, who's that? And then the voice on the other side, now it's a female, says, he asks for your husband. Is he not there? Then you say, no, I'm his wife. And the line goes dead. Are you going to tell me that you don't have now 100 questions to ask your husband when you see him? So between then and the time you see your husband, you're preparing an exam paper for him, aren't you? With the marking scheme? He must get at least 9 out of 10 to pass that paper, mustn't he? Are you going to suggest that you're going to stay completely silent, peace within, and you see your husband, hey, got a call from someone, just letting you know, and you're going to continue with your life? If you can do that, then you're not a wife. I mean, really, if you can do that, what I've just said, just continue with your life and no doubts, no suspicions whatsoever, then actually you're not a wife, you're an arahant living at home. What are you doing there? Come to the Anagarikarana or something. Let's be honest. I mean, let's face the facts. These are the worries and the fears that torment our lives from which we need to elevate ourselves. And that's why you're here on a Sunday morning. You're here for a dose of Dhamma because you know that these are problems that you have. You know, give yourselves a pat on the back because you accept that you have problems. And you know you've tried despite every effort. You know that you can't change the people around you because they are always going to be them. Right? And there will be situations, there will be circumstances, and you cannot be always in control of what goes on around you. But they always seem to take your peace away. They always seem to bother you and frustrate you. And therefore now you're looking for something solid. Some substantial solutions which can be yours forever and then problem done. Sorted. That's why you're here. Perhaps there are individuals here who've had counseling, therapy, family counseling, relationship counseling. Because you just couldn't get it to work between the two of you. You make an effort, which is good. You make an effort to try and keep the relationship together. But do you realize that at that point, at least at that point, do you not realize that it is something that has to be kept together? Meaning it's not something you can take for granted? Meaning it's conditioned? Meaning then that it cannot be happiness? That's what I mean. I've got nothing against you being married or as husbands, wives, spouses, you know, it's not that. But my problem is actually not with any of these things. My problem is simply this. Your pursuit for happiness, that philosophy is flawed. I'm here to share with you an alternative philosophy, ladies and gentlemen. Your philosophy is flawed. If you think that happiness is out there, it's just a matter of time before I somehow catch up with it. That's why half the time you go, you do your shopping and you bring in more than what your body needs. You also bring in what your mind needs. Take stock of what you bring in back home when you, after you go do your shopping, and check them against your shopping list. Right? 9 times out of 10, there'll be something in there that you never wanted. But when you were there, and it was staring at you in your face, it looked colorful, it looked nice, it smelled nice, at least the banner said that it does, and then you just felt like it is something that you had to purchase. So you bought it. But we're talking about food. Food is just energy packed up. Energy is just something your body needs, not something your mind needs. But when something looks colorful, something looks delicious, the mind yearns for it. That's because you believe happiness comes in that. These are those moments when you lose your peace. Fortunately, in life, you go through these ups and downs. Therefore, it's not always pain and torture that you go through. And this is the only reason that life is bearable. Okay? The only reason that life is bearable is because it's not always the negative stuff, or you the so-called negative stuff. In between two sorrows, there's always a relief. There's a moment of laughter between two moments of sorrow. And therefore life becomes bearable. But that's how life is. I mean, it doesn't have to be like that. You have settled for that, is what I'm saying. You have settled for this way of life because in between two moments of pain, there seems to be a moment of laughter. I mean, you've made do with life like that. It's kind of like a deal you struck with life. Like, you know, it's fine, I'll cry, but at least once in a while make me laugh. Let me laugh. That's the deal you struck with life. I don't know whether you remember, but once I asked you this question, and I'll ask it again. It seems like the opportune moment for that. If I specify a particular day, a particular time in the future, can you promise me that at that time and on that day you will be happy? Can you give me a guarantee? I'll write the time upon the board in a moment. Right? There'll be a date and a time. Can you guarantee that at that time you will be happy? Can you? Can you? Why not? Why not? Because you don't know what card life will deal you. Right? Okay. You can't guarantee that because it is I who asked you that question, right? Okay, then you give me a time and date. It's to my time and date you can't guarantee your happiness. Fine. Then you give me a date and time at which you can guarantee that you shall be happy. Come on. Anyone? Why don't let's pick your birthday? Surely that day is just going to be full of joy and laughter and fun and happiness, right? Your birthday? No? Why not? No? Why not? Come on, it's your birthday after all. Oh, I'm laughing at you, don't you understand? Why have you settled for this is my question. Why is it okay that life is like that to you? You're okay with life just dealing you whatever. I mean, when life decides today you're going to be unhappy, you'll be unhappy. When it decides, well, actually, I'll give you 2 minutes of happiness, you're okay with that. Come on. Why do you insult your intelligence? Aren't you smarter than that? See, look at how hard you work for happiness. What do you do Monday to Friday, 9 to 5? What do? You work. What for? Don't tell me money. That's not what anyone works for. No one works for money. Because what can money do? Money can't bring happiness. What do you do with money? You spend money to buy things, to purchase things that you believe make you happy. So why do you need money? To be happy. Then why do you work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5? For happiness. Okay? See, this is how much you have invested in this relationship that you have with life. Okay? So the deal is between you and life. Right? Let's see whether the contract terms and conditions are favorable to you. Right? I'm just going through your contract with life. Right? Permit me to do so. And let's see whether you have struck favorable terms when you signed that contract with life. So what is the contract you signed with life? Start from the beginning. 13 years of schooling. Now, before that you had preschool. Yeah? Nursery, then comes preschool, is it? Okay? And then school. So how many years of that? Almost 16, 17 years of that. Okay? This is the contract that you have with life. I'll give you all this. Let me be happy. is your agreement with life, isn't it? I mean, look at the contract. You will see these are the terms that you agreed to. So about 16 years of schooling, let me be happy. So after 16 years of schooling, put your hand up if you are happy. Like from that day on, I was just happy as a bunny. Not a moment, not a day went past where I was unhappy. So I mean, answer, after that 16 years of my investment of myself in life, life was very fair. And all it gave me was happiness in exchange. Put your hand up. Okay, right, let's continue then. What happened after school? University, okay. How many years of that? 3 or 4, felt like? Exactly, right, you know what that felt like. 3 or 4 years of university felt more like another 10 years of university, right? Because of the countless hours of sleepless hours, all those headaches, all those Red Bulls, right? Trying to keep yourself up, all, you know, overnight stays, pizzas to get by the day, right? Unhealthy diets, unhealthy sleeping patterns, right? Unhealthy friends, unhealthy habits, right? All of that you took upon yourself. Because you struck a deal apparently with life, and life promised you, go through university and I will keep you, what? Happy. Okay, so you went through university then. And at the end of those 3 to 4 years, you got your degree. Right, then put your hand up if since then you've been happy. So how many years by now? 16 schooling, another 3 or 4 years, let's put 4 years there, just for doctors. Doctors must be happy, surely. I mean, they put 5. Right? Because the more you put in, the more you should get out of it, right? So let's put 5 then. 16 plus 5, 21, round it up to 20, give or take. Okay? So 20 years by this point, a man doesn't live 100 years by now. Right? We don't live that long these days, right? At most, maybe 80. Oh, sorry. Can I take that back? Fortunately, no Armstrong today. 120. Forgive me, 120. Okay, 120. Not you lot. You lot lived in 200. I'm talking about, you know, the average Joes, right? Joes and James, the average Joes and James, they live up to 80, unlike you, because you're always happy, you know, right? You're always very happy. And so you live for a long and healthy life, but most people don't live that long, right? So 80. So by this point, you've already expended how many of those 8 years? 20. That's one quarter already spent. Right? So what was the deal again with life? I give you years of my existence and in exchange, you give me happiness. So by that point, you completed university and then from then on, you were happy. If you fit this description, please put your hand up. So what, you didn't go to university? And that's because that was the first degree. You got to do your master's. It's that one. Right, then let's go postgraduate. So then comes the postgraduate diplomas, postgraduate certificates, and postgraduate degrees, right? Then you get your master's. Another how many years? One or two? One? Two? One or two? Okay, two. Let's put two. Okay, so by this point you've expended 24 years. 24? Ah, okay, with 21 plus 2, 23 years. Now round it up to 25. Let's work with round numbers. 25 years. So you've done your master's. If you're happy, if you have been happy since then, put your hand up. Ah, no, of course, we have to do our PhDs. That's why we are not happy yet. I'm sure there are at least a few PhD holders in this room. So I ask the question then, how many more years for a PhD? 3 years? 3 to 5 years? Right, so we are at 25 now. Let's put another 5. Why not, right? I mean, it's just years of life, right? Let's just put it in there. I mean, it's all we have. It doesn't cost us anything or anything, right? So let's just put in another 5 years. Why not? After all, we'll keep our part of the deal and surely they'll keep their part of the deal, won't they? Yeah, I mean, this is all is fair in this game. So let's keep true to our part of the deal. Let's put as much of what we have as possible. Surely life will give as much happiness as possible. Let's put in another 5. By this point, we are 30. So, having done your PhDs, since then, if all you've been is happy, please put your hand up. So then it seems like the academic part doesn't work. Let's try something else then. The problem is with the academic part. Yeah. So anyone here who's looking forward to doing their PhDs and their masters, right? Well, you've learned a lesson from this audience. Don't waste your breath. Don't waste your effort. Don't waste your money. Because if happiness is what you expect at the end of that, you ain't getting any of it. I mean, come on. You know, there's enough evidence in the room and more. If happiness is what you're after, you're not going to get that. And I cannot accept that it is anything more or less than happiness that you're after anyway. Because why do you need your PhD? So that you could be educated, you can do something for the world, yes, fair enough, and expect what in return? Not necessarily money all the time, but satisfaction. Right? Satisfaction for having done something for the world, contributed something to humanity, the advancement of technology, science, medicine, whatever you want to call it. But get what out of it in exchange? Happiness. But surely, if you've put in 25 to 30 years of your life and then invested all that energy in something and you've been given some satisfaction, it should last at least for 5 years. What's the return rate on this? 30 years of your life, if you can't even get a five-year package of happiness. I tell you, the only time you were happy that you got your PhD was the day of the convocation. They called your name up on stage. So you came up on the stage and then the dean, he handed your certificate out to you and then you went, hey, I got my PhD, threw that thing up in the air, took a few photos and that was it. And then from time to time, when people call you up and say, doctor, you used to be called Mr. Mrs. and now you're called doctor. So that gives you this like little tickle, right? But for those little tickles, you put in 30 years of your life? I mean, are you so easily satisfied? Just for a few tickles? You're happy to invest 30 years of your life? Seriously? You know what the Buddha says? He gives us a course. The Buddha gives us a course and he says, if not in 7 years, or rather he says, if not in 7 days, at the most in 7 years, if you do this mindfully, you will be happy forever. He gives us a cast iron guarantee. I'll repeat. He says, if not in 7 days, because you're not diligent in your practice, if not in 7 days, then at most in 7 years. If you are diligent in your practice and you do this mindfully and virtuously, righteously, and apply yourself properly to this path, you will be granted a happiness that is unshakable, yours to have and yours to enjoy till the end of your life. 7 years is all he asks for. What did you invest? 30. How much happiness did you get? Not even 30 minutes worth. Just for a few tickles. I know it's not the certificate you want. I know, I'm not going to undermine you and say, you know, it's just, you just wanted a certificate or a few credentials next to your name. I know, I'm sure that's not what you wanted out of it. Every effort we make in life is because we want happiness out of it. No other reason. Either for ourselves because it makes us happy directly, or for others because seeing them happy makes us happy. That's why. That's what you do for your friends. That's what you do for your relations. That's what you do for your children. That's what you do for your village. That's what you do for your country. That's what you do for the world. Because seeing people happy makes you happy. So ultimately, what are we after? Our happiness. So I disagree with this sentiment that it's money that makes the world go round. I don't agree with that. I say it's happiness that makes the world go round. People do everything because it makes them happy. Or at least they hope that it makes them happy. So by this point, 30 years of your life invested. How much happiness? So for the PhD holders in the room, I ask you a question. Now that you are very educated, you are at the pinnacle of your academic career, right? Here's my question. Give me a date and time and the future at which you can guarantee that you will be happy. Ask life and tell me. It's fine. I want a date and a time at which you can promise me that you will be happy. I mean, come on, it's just one. One date and time is all I'm asking. Don't give me 100. Just give me one. I mean, for the 30 years you put into your education, surely you can expect that out of it. No? Then what was the point? I ask you, what was the point then? Yes, we got it wrong. It's not the academic part that makes us happy. It's something else. Right, let's look at something else then. Let's spoil it for everyone, right?
Could it be for survival?
What matter?
Could it be for survival?
Yes.
That you carry on not knowing the down.
So the question, could it be for survival? Survival makes us happy. We like to survive. I mean, no one wants to die tomorrow. Remember the other day I asked you if we had to make a list of who's to die next, who did you put up in the list? First it was the prisoners, right? Huh? And then came the cancer patients, right? And I say, how dare you? And then came the handicapped, I think. But who was last in the list? Me, yeah. See, you can call it whatever, but ultimately all these things finally round up and come to one little thing, happiness. You want to survive because it makes you happy. Survival makes you happy. You want to survive. You want to live. You want to exist because it makes you happy. You want to see another day. You want to spend time with your friends, your family, because it makes you happy. Because, you know, don't take my word for it. What happens when you've had enough with your friends, your family, whatever? What do you do then? You either say goodbye and you go home, or you split up. When you think that living with this individual for the rest of my life is going to make me happy, you get to get together with them onto the poru. When one day comes, you decide, actually, you know, living with this man or this woman is the last thing I want for the rest of my life, then you get into the poru care. What do? You split up with the same intensity of the same strength and the same intensity of intention with which you get together with someone. With that same intensity, there will come a day. There may come a day when you decide that you no longer want to be in that relationship. With that same intensity, you will want to be away from them. And then you will go to the best lawyers in the country to try and split that relationship up as soon as it is legitimately possible. Because the last thing you want to see is that man's face or that woman's face. And then the next thing is, how much of my wealth, my property, might he or she try and get out of me? See, before that it was, how can I share everything I have with him and her? Huh? I want to share everything with you. I want to share my life with you. I want to share my money with you. I want to share my children with you. I want to share everything with you. And then there comes a day after that, I will not let him have a penny. See? It's like people have been rebooted with no knowledge whatsoever about the state of mind they were in when they got into that relationship in the first place. Think. This is what happens when you go pursuing happiness. That is the only problem here, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing else. Now, it's not the problem. Marriage is not the problem. Divorce is not the problem either. Having kids is not the problem. Deciding not to have kids is not the problem either. Going out, staying in, partying, drinking, dancing, none of these things are the problem. The problem is when you do any of these things for the purpose of happiness, that's the problem. Eat because you need food. Eat as much as you want because you need food. Drink because you need to drink. Drink as much as you want. You don't need to moderate it. Drink as much as you want, but because you need it. But when you drink for the purpose of happiness, that's the problem. Because happiness is not something that can be found by doing something. If it were, there'd be a fundamental problem with happiness, and that is happiness would be conditioned. I don't want that kind of happiness. I don't know about you. Why would you want a happiness that always has to be fed, sustained, maintained, provided for? Don't you realize that that sort of happiness would make you, would exhaust you? Don't you realize that? If happiness was something you had to keep striving for, working and tiring yourself out for, don't you realize that that sort of happiness would exhaust you sooner or later? Is that a deal you want to make with life? But isn't that the deal you seem to have made with life? Don't you think it's time you found a new lawyer who helped you go through the fine points of the terms and conditions, the fine print? When you came into existence, you signed this contract with life. But perhaps you didn't read the small print. All I can say is you didn't find a good lawyer. Because that lawyer never pointed out to you that you would be spending all that you have in exchange for nothing. That is the truth. So we were going to burst a few more bubbles. Let's not spoil that. Let's come back. So we've now exhausted the academic path. Let's try something else. Relationships. Right? So let's go back to our younger years. Who here remembers their first crush? Ah, good. I have a few nods. No, I'll put my hand up as well. I've been there, done that, you know. We're all the same after all. The only difference between you and I is not our experiences, it's just our different philosophy. Just a different philosophy of life, that's all. That is the only place we differ. Experience-wise, we are pretty much the same. Done many of the same things, made many of the same mistakes. I corrected ourselves by having many of the same teachers, but ultimately, one of us decided to take a different philosophy for life. That's why I don't take lessons from you. That's why you're here to listen to this sermon, and I'm not there to listen to that sermon. Reason being, you give me a date and a time, and I will guarantee to you that I will be happy at that time. You name your day, name your time. You know, just to really make it, just really randomize it, why don't you give the date, you give the time. How about that? Or bring a box into which you can just drop your dates and times into it. Right? And I'll pick one at random. Okay? I'll pick one at random. Close my eyes, look away, pick one at random, and I'll tell you, I will be happy at this time, and then I will read it. How about that? How about that? So I won't check it first. I'll first announce that I will be happy, and then I check it. Check the date and time. How about that? Can you do that? Why not? Philosophy of life. Your philosophy is flawed. That's why. But remember, you can change all this. If I can, you can. I'm not a superhuman. I'm just a very average bloke. Just a very average, very ordinary human being. But I know how to make good use of my merits. So if you can learn to do the same thing, ladies and gentlemen, make good use of your merits. Because we all have merits. And no one can deny that. We all have merits. We just need to learn to make good use of our merits. That's all. So for that, we need a good lawyer. We need a good teacher. So remember your first crush then. Right? When you had that crush, how old were you? Too young. Too young to remember. Okay, let's say you were... I don't know, what's the going age these days? These days, you know, I think it's probably months, right? She's 6 months and she's got her first crush. But when we were younger, you know, it was probably more like years, yeah? And now it's like months. In a few years' time, she's like, she's got a crush on someone. A mother will be saying, pointing at her womb. The child's already still in the womb and he already has a crush on someone. It will be like that. You can't change that. Anyhow, when we were younger, right, let's say boy's 5 or 6 or something and he has his first crush on someone. Right, we've all been there, we've all done that, you have that experience. Right? Where did you think your happiness was going to come from? Being with that individual, right? You wanted to spend time with him or her. So what happened then? Maybe in some cases you were not able to go ahead with that because circumstances changed. You know, they moved. They packed up and they moved, so then you never got to see them again, perhaps. Maybe your family migrated and then you never met again. Some of you tried long distance relationships. How was that for size? Worked? I had that experience of long distance relationship. So those who have had long distance relationships or are still in a long distance relationship, happy, right? You're happy, right? So that works, doesn't it? I mean, you name it. I mean, whatever it is that you have in your bag that works, right, let's bring it forward. Let's put it on the table. Let's examine it and make sure that we find the right ingredients to cook happiness. Because we are all so very experienced in this effort, in this endeavor of trying to cook up happiness. So many years of experience, if you count all the number of years across the room. I mean, certainly over 1,000.
Yikes.
100. And we have a room full of very experienced individuals. Maybe actually tens of thousands. All those years of experience, let's bring the right ingredients to cook up happiness. So the crush didn't work. Then parents said, no relationships now. Now's the time to do the previous one. What was it? Study. Because if you don't focus on your studies, if you get distracted, then what did they say would happen? Let's see whether they were right. What did they say would happen? If you don't focus on your studies and get into all these relationships, right, then you would not be able to do your studies properly, and then you would not be able to get your degree, and then your master's, and then your PhD, and be happy. Right? So for those of you who were obedient to their parents and therefore did not have their crushes, did not get into any of those relationships, you followed on that career, didn't you? And you got your PhD. Are you happy now? So today you can go and ask your parents, right? The younger ones in the room. You can say, Amma, today Swami Nuhase talked to us about this academic career. And he said that, you know, you always say don't get into these relationships, don't have crushes, don't go out with boys and hang out with girls and all that because it's going to completely distract us from my education. And then it will take me a longer time or not even be able to get my PhD and so whatnot. But then I won't be happy anyway after it. So why not? So why not have my relationships along the way? At least, you know, I know I'm going to get into a train crash. Might as well enjoy the ride. So, first relationship. You may remember your first relationship. First serious relationship. Do you remember getting into it? And how you felt like he or she was sent from heaven. I mean, like there was an individual on this planet. There's only one of them. Like one individual in this planet who was crafted by God. The divine powers that they are, right? Designed meticulously. The looks, the words, the character, right? All of that just for you, right? The way she looked at you, you were dead certain she'd never looked at anyone else like that before, right? Huh? And then the way he spoke to you, and the way he said, hey, you were dead certain that he'd never uttered those words to anyone before you, weren't you? Isn't that why you blushed? Didn't you feel that you were the only person that was special to them? And when your hands touched for the first time, it was not a proper grasp, right? It was just a very, you know, just a... You know, like just a very random, you know, very unplanned but planned. You know, just brushed like that. But remember, you remembered that experience for the rest of the week? Because it was his hand after all. It was her hand after all. No other hand made your hand feel that way? Remember, it's okay to nod because everyone's nodding, so it's fine. You find it's funny, don't you? So do I. We were all there. I lived that life. I know what that felt like. Because you thought at that point, here's the person who's going to make your life complete. Your mother couldn't do it, your father couldn't do it. Your brother couldn't do it, your sister couldn't do it, because there was this one person who we are going to meet, right? It was prophesied that you would meet this person, right? You went to the, what do you call them? Astrologist, right? Right? They looked at your horoscope and they said, at this age, you are going to meet this person and they will change your life forever. And they did, didn't they? So you thought happiness served. Do you remember that relationship and getting into it? How many lessons did you learn from that relationship, I asked you? Actually, who you met was not a girlfriend or a boyfriend. What you met was a teacher. Don't you agree? Wasn't who you met a teacher? Wasn't that a teacher after all? How many lessons did they teach you on how not to? Yes or no? Countless lessons on how not to. That's what you learn from your first relationship. How not to trust. Not how to trust, how not to. And why not to. How not to and why not to give you everything, because you will lose it all in ways that you may never be able to earn back. Think. All because in each one of those instances, you form into another subcontract. Because you had this one grand contract with life, right? That I will do whatever life deems that I ought to at that time. And then with each individual, each encounter, you form these subcontracts, right? With those crushes, with those boyfriends, with those girlfriends that you had, you form these little subcontracts. And in each of those contracts, the only thing you expected in return was one thing alone. That was it. Nothing else. You never swayed from that. It was always one thing. What was that? Happiness. Why didn't you stop to think that they were looking for it from you? Why did that not compute in your minds? The fact that they were looking for it from you must have spoken volumes to you, must it not have? Because if they'd had it with them, why would they have come to you? So weren't you getting on your knees and begging it from someone who didn't have it in the first place? And therefore they were coming to you for it? And then you realize, I don't have it. That's why I'm going to him. So then surely he doesn't have it. That's why he's coming to me. Then shouldn't the two people have met and said, hey, you go happiness? No. You go happiness? No. Let's walk around and walk away. Shouldn't that what have happened? But is that what happened? No. Because you each other promised. You promised to each other, I will make you happy if it's the last thing I do. I will do the same. So then, those who got into that relationship, and then those who legalized that relationship, those who solidified that relationship, those who went ahead, right, and affirmed that relationship, I ask you, are you? Are you happy now? You know, when you come here on Sundays, husbands and wives sit apart from each other, okay? it's fine to come as a couple, but you sit away from each other because then it's easier to answer my questions. Because otherwise you'll be like glancing to the right and glancing to the left. I can imagine, like, you know, they're probably sitting together, holding hands at the start of the sermon, but towards the end of the sermon, they're like this. I can just imagine what it must be like. Swami Nathu slowly teaches those lessons that you should have learned, but you didn't. What was the problem? It was not getting into the relationship. That wasn't the problem. It was not getting married. That wasn't the problem either. It was not finding a house together, deciding to live together, look after each other's needs and wants. That was not the problem. What was the problem? Expecting to find happiness out of it. That was the problem. See, by that point, countless times before that, you'd already tried it and you'd failed. But here's the thing with life. There are some lessons you never learn. Therefore, you keep on making the same mistakes time and time and time and time again. Some mistakes, you repeat the very mistake that you made once. Therefore, I'm sure there will be people among you who tied the knot more than once. Maybe even twice. Maybe three times. Maybe you're waiting for the fourth. What makes you think that what you didn't find in the first, the second, and the third, you will find in the fourth, ladies and gentlemen? What makes you think that the happiness you didn't find with your parents, with your siblings, with your crush, with your first boyfriend, you will find in your fourth husband? What makes you think that 30 years of your life in academia, and trying to get to the pinnacle of that, you will find in another 30 years of existence or living together with your spouse? What makes you think that? Once again, I repeat, and I want to emphasize this point because I don't want you to walk away or walk out of this room with the wrong idea. It's not that I have a problem with these social constructs. Let them be. Right? Let people live together. Let people try and keep each, you know, address people's needs and wants and all that. Let the world function as it does. I have no problem with that. My only problem is with this. You have the wrong philosophy when it comes to happiness. You expect happiness to come to you from the outside because you believe that happiness can be made. That it can be cooked up somewhere in the laboratory of life somewhere. It can be cooked up in a relationship. It can be cooked up at work. It can be cooked up at university. That's what you think, and that's what's wrong. It's time to throw that stove away. Because there is no such thing called happiness. Happiness is not something that you can make. And if it were, that would be a pretty bad deal. Because you'd always have to keep making it. Nothing in this world is ever made. Nothing is done. Nothing's finished. Nothing's finished. The richest man in the world, done? Done? No, why not? For now. Always for now. The fastest car? For now. The biggest house? For now. The smallest house? Again for now. All these superlatives, they must always come with a for now. The most educated person in the world is who? Whoever, for now. Do you know why that is? Because the most educated person in the world is not happy yet. Therefore, they will try to educate themselves a little bit more. Because that's what they're used to doing. Because they think somewhere down that path they shall find happiness. That's why the richest man in the world is still busy trying to make more money. Yes, I admit that if they stopped making money, the world's economy would collapse and all that, right? So they help and they support the world's economy to function. granted. I give you that, no problem at all with that. As I say, there's no problem with any of that. I'm not here to tear up the social fabric or to, you know, to completely take away anything from the economy or anything of that sort. No, let the world operate as it does. My only problem is this. If people are doing what they're doing for the sake of happiness, there's a problem there. Because happiness is not something that you can make. It's not something you can fabricate. Because if it was, it would be a very exhausting task. Very tiresome task. Very burdensome task. So then, do you realize that it's ironical? Because what is happy, if you have to put in a lot of effort to make it, then the effort that you have to put in takes away any worth of that happiness, does it not? Because actually true happiness should be unconditional. It should require no effort at all. That is what true happiness should be. It should require no effort at all. You have to discover that happiness. I mean, if such happiness does not exist, and a happiness that does not require maintenance, sustenance, effort, if such happiness does not exist, let's just disband, closes, let's call it a day, let's all go home. Because there would be no point in us coming together like this and having a chat, because, you know, we've all tried and we're still trying, and there are so many different avenues. There are people out there who buy property in the hope that one day they will be happy and content, because acquiring property makes them happy. And they won't just stop at their own countries. They'll go and try and acquire property in other countries. And sometimes they might even try and acquire parts of the world, maybe islands on their own, and hope that that will make them happy. But there's no end to it. Why is there never an end to it? It's because that last thing they did didn't make them happy. It was just a tickle. See, all these things are like tickles, actually, because you're only, when you tickle yourself, I mean, you can't tickle yourself, but when someone tickles you, you burst into a laugh, but only for that time, right? When they stop, you stop. That's why all these pleasures, this pursuit of pleasure is a mere tickle. And like I said, when you do that, you depend on others. See, you have just handed over the keys of your happiness to me. Therefore, now you're at my mercy. Why do you want to be like that? Now you're happy. Now you're not. Why do you want to be at my mercy? Why don't you want to be at your own? Then I'm the master and you're the slave. I get to decide when you're happy. See? I don't want you to be happy now. I want you to be happy again. Actually, no, I don't. See? Do you see the danger with that? Wives, tell me, is it not your husbands who decide when you're happy and when you're not at home? You might say no, but let's be honest, isn't that the truth? Haven't you handed over your keys of happiness to them? And sometimes they say things and it completely ruins your mood. And you are broken and you're broken to pieces. And sometimes for a few days, maybe even for a couple of weeks. And then sometimes they'll try and put you back together again, but it doesn't work. Why? Because you've handed over the keys of your happiness to someone else. Because you think happiness comes from the outside. That's why you do that. Because you think happiness is something that can be made, can be fabricated, can be cooked. It's not like going to a restaurant and ordering your food and the chef brings it to you and you can eat it. Happiness is not like that. Now let me plug you back to last week's conversation. See how all this links together. And I also gave you a bit of homework. I said, see your car or look at your car but not see it. You remember? Look at your house but not see it. Excuse me. I said, look at your family but not see it. Look at the party but not see it. I distinguish between seeing and looking. By which I meant, do see if you can try and interpret all existence as a coming together of energy, of causes to manifest a necessity. We're talking about dukkha. Can't see? Must be the pen. I'll try another one. This might be better actually. That better? Back? Okay, thanks. Dukkha. So the first thing I wanted to get across to you last week was that it would be inappropriate and it would undermine the profoundness of this discovery by the Buddha if we simply said that dukkha was this. When you are sad, unhappy, because these are feelings, these are emotions. Dukkha is not an emotion. It's not a feeling. It's not the feeling of disappointment or frustration or anger or sorrow or grief or so on. Actually, this is not something that you can feel. It's only something you can perceive through insight, wisdom. This is a discovery of an individual who spent countless eons trying to figure out what was happening in the universe, what the universe actually is. And therefore he summed it up in one word. The universe is dukkha. Which is why last week I made several references. Although the English translations for the noble truths are the noble truth of suffering, the cause of suffering and so on, when we translate dukkha to suffering, we lose a great deal of its depth. So it's not right for us to actually say that dukkha is suffering. Suffering is a type of dukkha, but dukkha itself is not suffering. Therefore, to say that the Four Noble Truths are the Four Noble Truths of suffering is to undermine the meaning of this word and the profoundness of the discovery that the Buddha made and shared with the rest of the world. So, what we discussed last week, a quick refresher, is that this conveys to us cause and effect. This word has in it an expression of cause and effect. This is in fact a cause and an expression of cause and effect, like you have a mathematical formula for something. This is a formula that explains everything that is there out there, existence. What I explained to you was ka was body, kaya or body, and du was deficiency. So then, all bodies, in other words, in aggregates, all aggregations happen in response to a deficiency, to fulfill a deficiency. So now you see, we're not talking about emotions here. Although, albeit, emotions themselves are bodies in response to a deficiency. So really, this is a mere subset of the larger category of dukkha. Dukkha is everything. This is only a subset of that, a very small part of that. Actually this, what about that? That's not dukkha, right? Because that's not suffering. It is also dukkha. As long as whatever we draw on the board or whatever we refer to is conditioned, it is a dukkha. What about something that's unconditioned? Is that a dukkha? Is that a dukkha? No. Because the word dukkha, the meaning of dukkha, the idea of dukkha, the concept of dukkha is how conditioned things form. See, here are the causes. Here's the effect. This is the deficiency, which is the cause. Here's the effect, which is the body. So the body is formed in response to the deficiency. So what will you tell me about the pen then? Is this a pen? It's not dukkha, surely. There's no suffering here. There's no suffering here, right? There's nothing to do with suffering. Right, so this is to trip you. I keep throwing things like that at you. I'm trying to deliberately trip you, and you mustn't trip and fall. If you have understood this, then you must be steady in your knowledge, in your understanding, and not let even the Buddha trip you. Your understanding of this should be so solid that if the Buddha were to come up to you and argue otherwise, you should be able to inform the Buddha, "Venerable sir, you may be the most of everything, but dukkha is dukkha. It is not suffering." And the Buddha will praise you for that. I mean, that is what to learn from a teacher is. Once you become a student, if you are a proper student, and you learn what the teacher has taught you, then you should be able to be with conviction and confidence about what you have learned. Be able to even argue with you, not like having to get into an argument. What I mean is to be able to put forward your arguments to your teacher in a way that even the teacher is then not able to, shall we say, deny or reject your ideas and thoughts, provided that it is the truth. Because the truth is the truth. The truth does not need conditions to support it, does it? Only falsehoods need evidence and support. The truth does not need any evidence. Then, dukkha. This word entails that all forms of existence, everything that is conditioned by a deficiency. So then what would happen if the deficiency ceases to exist? If there is no longer a deficiency, then there will no longer be this body in this manner, in this structure, in this order. In fact, the coming together of energy as a body is what we call putting order into this world. So when chaos goes to order, when chaos goes to order, this is what happens. When chaos goes to order, what happens is, before chaos goes to order, there must be a deficiency. So a deficiency will drive chaos to order. Meaning that order is only sustained by this deficiency. Is this making sense to you, ladies and gentlemen? Yeah? If it's not, just put your hand up. Okay. Let's go through that again. Dukkha is not about suffering. Are we clear on that? It's not about being sad and angry or disappointed, or when your mother passes away, your grievances. It's not about that, because even animals experience those emotions. So it would not be right to say that the Buddha's purpose of coming to this world is to teach us about suffering, because everyone knows suffering. There's nothing to teach about it. We all suffer. But what we don't know is why we suffer. And what is the fundamental basis of suffering? So the Buddha's purpose was that. Not to teach us suffering, but to teach us about and why and what suffering is after all. Okay? So then when we try to look at, when we observe and understand this word dukkha, which is what the Buddha gave us, this is his gift to mankind and to all sentient beings, I want you to understand this as a description of the phenomenon that all things exist because energy that is by default in chaos. What do I mean by chaos? where there's no order. So you see now, right now you're all sat in these rows and columns, and right, we are sat here because there's a sermon here. So at the end of the sermon, what happens? Chaos. Bad example. There's nothing wrong with that, right? Chaos is fine. But actually, that is still an order. It may not be the organizer's order. It's your order, though. See, you are where you want to be, isn't it? At the end of this sermon, you stand up, you know, you do your worship in the Swami Nuhasa, you offer your pirikara and all that, and after that, you're just all over the place. To anyone observing that, they'll say, you're all over the place. But to you, you're not all over the place. Yeah, you are in agreement and in adherence to your order. You are where you want to be. So who's to say that that is chaos? Do you see, then, at the end of this talk, wherever you might be at any given time, that place is determined by your deficiency. Meaning, it's where you want to be. Because deficiencies are a lead on from necessities. The need to be something or somewhere or in some way or in some shape is what prompts the deficiency. This is what creates a deficiency. So, for example, if you want to be at the end of this room on the other side, the moment you feel that and you're on this side, now there's a necessity to be on the other side, but there's also a deficiency. What is that deficiency? The fact that you're not there yet. Then what happens? At that point, you will feel that this is chaos. So now you have to put order to that chaos. And how do you do that? You expend energy. You expend energy. By expending energy, what do? You put yourself, you take yourself where you want to be. And once you're there, you say, now, order. This is order. But for someone else, that might not be. Someone says, hey, what are you doing there? Come here. And then if you are willing to be obedient to that call, to respond to that call, then you might say, ah, okay, I will. And then you change order, you change your place again, because again you see that that is chaos. So let's take a classroom, for example. What better place to take an example as a classroom than to be in one, right? So now let's say at the start of the class, so the bell rings and it's time for the class. As the teacher walks into the room, in a typical school, right, children will be all over the place. That they'll be talking to their friends, they'll be playing, they'll be doing whatever. And then the teacher walks up to the walks up to their station, and the teacher says, all right, come on, children, it's time for your class. And then what do children do? Why do they come and take their places? Why do they do that? Now, you have to think about how that happens. Think about what's actually going on from an energy level. What's going on is this. When the teacher was not in the class, the child might have been with his friend or her friend. They were there because that to them at that time was order. Because if it was just after the previous period and they had something to do with their friend, being where they are and the friend being on the other side of the class, that was chaos. So what did they want to do? Take themselves to be with their friend. So a deficiency came first, and in response to that deficiency, energy was spent, and then that child took themselves across the room to be with their friend. So now that is order for them. But now the teacher comes in. To the teacher, this is not order. That situation is not order. So what does the teacher say? Order, like they do in the parliament. Yeah, you heard that, right? Order. Who says that? The speaker. The speaker says, order. And what do the parliamentarians do? Let's not go there. So it's like a shouting contest, right? Who can shout louder? So when the speaker says order, just like when the teacher says order, now, in the child's mind, if the child is aware And if the child is obedient to the teacher, so this is where the distinction is. If the child is obedient to the teacher, now carefully listen to this, and the child now accepts the teacher's order, like the order, then in the child's mind, now there's a deficiency. Because the child now wants to comply with the teacher's request / order. The moment the child wishes to comply with that request, there's now a necessity to be elsewhere, meaning in his designated desk. Now there's a deficiency. A similar deficiency to what was there when the last teacher left the class because he wanted to be with his friend. So now there's another deficiency to which this child responds by doing what? Carrying them back to their desk. So do you see that all these movements happen in response to deficiencies? There's no way you can move anything in this world or make anything happen in this world unless in response to a deficiency. Really think about this. There's nothing in this world that happens without a deficiency for it. Air doesn't flow from one place to another unless there's a deficiency. And then you call it a wind. We call it wind. From a place of high pressure to low pressure, there's a deficiency. Deficiency of pressure. Therefore, air flows. Water doesn't flow from a tank unless there's a deficiency. You throw something up in the air, then there's gravity. Let's call it gravity for now. But what there is really, there's a lot of energy in that object, right? And the surrounding environment, in the surrounding environment, there's a deficit of energy. Actually, that's how things fall. So if I put this up here and I took my hand away, what I've done is charge this up with potential energy. That's how this object is up here right now. I've charged it up with potential energy, expending chemical energy, which I took with my food. Yeah, and that's how this has energy now. Then if I took my hand away right now, the surrounding environment, meaning the environment here, lacks energy or is short of energy in comparison to this object. Therefore, the surrounding environment takes energy from this object. And as it does, it drops. Because when it starts expending potential energy, the height of this object will reduce until it comes to this point and it cannot fall any further. So this is how the whole universe works. Don't you see now then the dukkha is not about a sad face? I don't deny that dukkha can also be explained through dukkha, but it is not one and all. It's not one and the same. This is only a subset of dukkha, but then the happy face is also a subset of dukkha. This object is an experience of dukkha. This object dropping from above is also dukkha. Anything that is conditioned is dukkha. Anything that is unconditioned is not dukkha. That's why you call it sukha. Nibbanam paramam sukham. They don't say nibbanam paramam dukkha. So this is why last week I gave you the task of look at things physically, but see dukkha. Now think about your family, because we spoke a little bit about families and relationships. What is your relationship? Whatever your relationship is, be that your spouse relationship or your children's relationship, your family, is that an entity, a fixed, finished, done entity, or is it merely a body that is functioning in response to a deficiency? Think carefully. These are the really interesting things to understand. You will not learn this at university. Here's what they'll teach you at university. How these bodies interact with each other. That they'll teach you. They'll teach you how bodies interact with each other, and they call it physics, chemistry, biology, natural sciences, and then whatever extensions from that, they call it human sciences and so on. But they are incapable of taking it back to deficiencies and then to necessities. Because then we start talking about the mind, because the mind is the creator of all things. See, I can prove the point to you. Necessities only arise in minds. Because tanha, attachment, can only arise in a mind. Because tanha is driven by ignorance. There is nothing in this room that is ignorant besides your minds. These lights, they're not ignorant. The ceiling is not ignorant. The roof isn't ignorant. These plants, they're not ignorant. These pots, pans, whatever, these things, the cups, saucers, they're not ignorant. Your clothes are not ignorant. Your muscles are not ignorant. Your bones aren't ignorant. If there's ever anything ignorant about you, it can only be the mind. Therefore, it's only in the mind attachment can arise. An attachment is just another way of saying a necessity. Therefore, only where there's a necessity can a deficiency arise. Every deficiency is a product of necessity. So then I gave you the example before. You put water into a tank and you open it, and then the water flows from a place of high pressure to low pressure. So one might ask, where's the mind there? What's the mind doing there? Because there's no mind there to do any of that. Yes, agreed. But let's not forget that the world and everything in it, and the way the world works, all this physics and chemistry and all that stuff as to how the world works, was a product of the mind. That's why you can observe these various deficiencies in the world, because what created it, what produced it, was an instrument that goes through this necessity deficiency experience. Now it's getting very philosophical now. So you see, in the same sermon, in the first half, we were having fun. Laughing at ourselves and just, you know, having a very casual conversation. But you see, it all leads to a greater philosophy. That's why I always question, what is your philosophy for life? These are the takeaways. The first half was to start opening your minds, your brains, to start thinking about, hey, is there a problem? Swaminathan is going to give us a talk, but is there really a problem? There's no point prescribing drugs, medicines, if you don't know that you have an ailment. So then I'm taking that example of the family, spousal relationship. You'd be wrong to think that it's a fixed, done, deterministic entity. That's why people come together and people walk away. Why do they come together? What is it led by? Deficiency. See, when two people want someone else to be with, what happens then? They find someone to be with. And when they have found someone to be with and it ticks their boxes, remember, your husband doesn't love you, he loves you. Ah, good, you got it. And your wife doesn't love you, she loves you? She loves you? If. Right? So then, these ifs are those deficiencies. Those ifs are the deficiencies driven by necessities. These necessities are all shaped by their understanding of the world. Whatever they believe is nitya, sukha and artha. So for this conversation, I'm going to have to assume that you understand what nitya, sukha and artha are. We don't have time to get into the depths of that today. But maybe next week we can build up on that. So it's kind of like three sermons building up one on the top of the other. But who knows, I always promise you one and deliver something else, right? You know what I'm like. Because I simply respond to deficiencies. Yeah, I don't have a script. I don't come pre-cast. Right? I just respond to whatever nature wants of me. That's why. Anyway, coming back to the point before we digress. So your relationship then, all these ifs. I love my wife as long as she. I love my husband as long as he. As long as he, as long as she can be in one word is if. Those ifs are these deficiencies. See, I'll tell you one of those ifs which is pretty obvious. You might even laugh at this, but tell me whether it is not true. Your husband loves you as long as you are a woman. Do you see the depth of that point that I just said? So really, your husband doesn't love you. Whoever you are inside, that's not that's not what he loves. You have to be a woman for him to love you. Why does it matter whether you're a man or a woman? If he loves you, then why does it matter whether you're a man or a woman? No. You have to be a woman for that. Then is that not one of those big ifs? What if you had a sex change? I mean, these days we can talk about it because it's done, accepted socially, right? These things happen, right? So what if when you wanted to get a sex change done or a gender change, and you decided to do it and you didn't consult your husband, you just went and got it done. One fine day he comes home, he's like, who are you? I say, hello, I'm your wife, you say in a male voice. He says, you my wife? You're not my wife. I am. I've just gone through a gender change. What's the problem? He said, what's the problem? I married a woman. Now he starts throwing out all those conditions. So don't accept it when someone tells you, I love you. It's not you they love. Don't take that. They love you if you are a woman. Your wife loves you if you are a man. So you have to do manly things. You have to behave like a man. If you start behaving in a very effeminate way, maybe your wife might not like that. Perhaps one of the things she likes is the way you wear your beard. Maybe you have to have your beard, otherwise she's like, oh, it looks very, not like that. And I want a proper man, muscular. I need hair on the chest and hair on the face. Maybe. So it's not you they love. That's the point I'm trying to make. So don't be fooled. What if you decide one day to start growing your hair? Maybe your wife might not like that. And have one of those things called braids, right? Braids? Yeah? So what if you decide to have braids? Maybe he might not like that. But you ask her, what's the problem? I'm still your husband. No, I like a man. You don't look like a man anymore. So it's not you they love then. Deficiencies. Because that's what they went and found from the marketplace. The marketplace of potential suitors. That's who they found. A kaya, a body. Both mind and physical body. That would satisfy their deficiencies. Do you see how we are all driven by the same principles? The same fundamental principle of dukkha? That's why I said, look at your husband, don't see your husband. Look at your wife, but don't see one. See deficiency, sufficiency, necessity. Necessity drives deficiencies, deficiencies, sufficiencies respond to those deficiencies. It will keep on responding until it's sufficient. At that point, you'll draw a line and say, yeah, enough. It's like when you're at the salon. They keep cutting your hair, doing your thing up, and then they say, enough, enough, enough. You know, they hold the mirror. Once you've done your hair, right? They hold the mirror. The barber. They hold the mirror and say, enough. You know, check. Yeah, good, enough. Somebody say, no, can I have a bit more trimmed on this side? And a bit more on that side? So at what point do you say enough? When it meets your deficiency level, that's when you say it's sufficient. You don't want to go over, because the moment you go over, now to remove that, whatever is over, that extra, that becomes a deficiency. Then that becomes a new deficiency. So extra is no good, because that becomes a new deficiency. So when you go take your plate and your mother serves you your food, she says, Amma, yeah, hold it. They serve. Oh, enough. Too much. Then now what becomes a new deficiency? You have to get some of the food out of your plate. And if she takes out too much, no, a little bit more. And then put a little bit more. Now some of you might have this at home, like you there in the living room, you have to take your, serve it in the kitchen and take it, and maybe two or three times you keep going back and forth until it's right. That's why I say, study everything that you see through this lens. You'll be wiser for it. You'll begin to realize, in one word, the Buddha encapsulated all of existence. Everything, universally. There's nothing that you cannot encompass with this one word. Everything's encapsulated in this. If it's conditioned, it's here. If it's not conditioned, it's not here. There's only one thing that's not conditioned. What is it? Happiness. Say what? I know it's what you're thinking right now. You're like, whoa, hold on, Swami. So all these years of our life, we've been going after things, doing things, going on adventures, getting married, having children, educating ourselves, doing this, that, what, not. Because that was going to bring us happiness. And now you're just saying that the only thing in this world that is unconditioned is happiness? Yes. So, is this not a 180-degree turn from the path you took in life? Anya hila bhupanisa, anya nibbana gadani. The path to gain, the path to material possession is one. The path to happiness is another. Question all you like why I chose my life and to spend my life as a monk. This is not a life spent as a monk, although you call it that. Now underneath this robe, ladies and gentlemen, is merely a mind that is learning how to do nothing for the sake of happiness. That is who this is. You can call it a monk if you want. Because you see him in a robe, you say, it's a swami, that's a monk. Monks are looking for happiness. No, monks are not looking for happiness. They are trying to stop looking for happiness. Because we are so used to look for happiness. But see, to look for happiness is to do this. Look for happiness. Bring those bodies together. Aggregate things. But they are always in response to a deficiency. How can you fix here when this is broken? What good is to fix this, to bring stuff here, when the fundamental, at the base, it's broken? The foundation is broken. It's a deficiency, for heaven's sake. And a deficiency is driven by necessity. You cannot fix that. So So for as long as there's a necessity, there will always be deficiencies, and then forever you will always have to keep bringing this stuff. Aggregation, panchaskandha, always aggregate. You got to keep on doing this. Therefore, this is what we call existence. For as long as this body begins to aggregate here, the deficiency is what will require it. But remember, this is order, but the universe's natural order is chaos. Yeah? So do you see the two forces pulling, who are at odds with each other? There's your deficiency pulling it in that direction, and then the universe pulling in the opposite direction. Who's going to win? Because the universe will always outlive you. You want this flower to be like this, fully blossomed. That's why you went for a plastic flower. Right? Because the natural ones, they wither away too soon. So you think you won now. So you think you beat the universe, right? Because you made it and got it done in something artificial, therefore it will last forever. Really? See how much effort you put in? To make something that will live longer than what would normally live in a natural environment, because you want to see this. Because you want to see a fully blossomed flower, and you like these colors and this arrangement, and you don't like how nature has it, that nature will only let you have one of these for a few hours, maybe half a day at most. Right? So you don't like that. Therefore, what did you do? By you, I don't mean you. I mean you. You in general. What did people do? They started making these things out of artificial stuff, materials, plastics and so on, in the hope that they can keep it like this for longer, but only longer, not forever, because this is order in response to a deficiency. Whilst the deficiency keeps pulling on this and keeping it this way, there's a bigger force acting in the opposite direction. The universe, because now you have just upset universe's order. Because the universe's order is chaos. As the universe's order is chaos, only and for as long as deficiency is there, can you keep this in this shape. That's why if you let this be like this for a while, if you don't attend to it, what does it mean to attend to something? Is to keep shaping something, sustaining something to surface the deficiency, to furnish the deficiency. That is what it means to attend to something. That's why if you left this unattended for a while, there's a constant tug of the universe taking it back to chaos. That's why when you leave it like this for a while, it'll go back to the universe. That's what you have to do with your houses. That's why from the day you built it, it's been a non-stop struggle to keep it like that. Your cars, your relationships, your children, your gardens, your lawns, all of it, your bodies, your hair, your makeup. How many times must you touch up? You do it before you leave home for the day, but then soon after you get into work, what do? Before you get out of the car, what do? That's how you carry a little mirror in your bag, right? Your handbag, it comes out. I'm not going to do what you're going to do, but you pouch your lips, and then touch up, do all that, check in your mirror, and then, happy with that, get out of the bag, car and go in. But before you go to your next meeting, again. At the end of the day, before you get back home, again. And then if you have to pop to the shop before you get home, again. Because you never know who you might bump into. Might be your fourth husband. Who knows? Because if you do bump into your to-be fourth husband, he will have a list of deficiencies. Right? He will have a list of deficiencies. And if you don't tick those boxes, he's not going to have you. He wants to see you prim and proper, meaning to his order. Why do you do this to yourselves? Slaving to other people's desires and wants? Is that the value you give to yourselves, honestly? Is that what your parents brought you up for? Just to slave yourself in front of other people's orders and desires and wants and needs? Just so that you can fulfill someone else's deficiency? Because it's all based out of a necessity? Which is rooted in ignorance after all? So if you're the puppet, who's the puppeteer? Ignorance. So you are children of ignorance. You are puppets of ignorance. Is that a crown you would like to wear on your head? Do you see how you undermined yourselves by choosing not to understand the wisdom that the Buddha shared with you? Come on, you are adults, for heaven's sake. Grow up. Think about this stuff. For one, stop thinking like a child. Dig deeper. Look at what's really going on with your life rather than just be fooled by the superficial glamour. This glamour that's on the outside is not there in the inside. The inside is just empty. That's why the Buddha says that people who haven't understood the Dhamma are like empty vessels. They're pretty on the outside. On the inside, empty. No substance. This is what he says the Prutakjanas are like. A Prutakjana is someone who hasn't understood the Dhamma, who hasn't seen this truth, who doesn't realize the truth of what's really going on with them. Therefore, what do? Just like these pots. Outside, nicely done, decorated, looks pretty. On the inside, empty. So if you break one of these, what's on the inside? You find nothing. Is that how you want to live the rest of your lives? Glamorous on the outside, empty on the inside? Is it not time to give yourselves more worth, more value than that? To rise up and above the social norm? Just because everyone says that this is how you have to live your life, is that how you have to? You know, you earned this life yourselves. No one else gave this to you. This is your merits you are expending as human beings. No one else earned the merits on your behalf. When you run out of this, you run out of this, ladies and gentlemen. No one else can pump in some of their merits to you and say, here, take mine and live another 100 years. Although they say it in the songs, right? Siya kayu leva, mage kayu gana, marat padakal oba jeevatteva. Come on. Right, live for 100 years, and once you're done with that, take my life faculty and you live with that rest of it as well. Jokes. It's nice for a song, nice for a poem, nice for a bit of drama. That's all it is, it's a bit of drama. The truth is, once you've expended your merit, that's it, finished. But you see, as a human being, you still have the faculty to understand this. The moment you have expired your human merits, end of story. That is why you must waste your time at your own peril. You can choose not to come here on Sundays. It's fine. At your own peril. You can choose not to spend your time in the Dhamma. It's fine. At your own peril. Because it is not I who will have to pay the price. I have chosen not to spend my Sundays, but to spend the rest of my life days with the Dhamma. Because I knew that any moment I spend away from the Dhamma, I do at my own peril. And I'm not prepared to do that because no one is going to suffer the consequences of my wrong decision making. No one else but I. So please wake up to the truth, ladies and gentlemen. Please wake up to the truth. Understand that everything is merely a dukkha. Please understand that all formations, all conditioned formations, all sankhata is the product of a sankhara. Sankhara is the activity that brings the body together. Sankhara is what brings the aggregates together. It is the aggregation process. That's why they say sabbe sankhara anicchati. Sabbe sankhara dukkhati. Sabbe dhamma anattati. See, sankhara is what brings his body together. It is anicca by nature. What that means is, this body will only remain like that for as long as there's a deficiency. There has to be a cause, there has to be a pull, a tug, without which it will not be like that. Anicca. Because this body has no preference to be like this. This body has no preference to be like this. Right? It has no preference. It has no bias to be like this. The only reason it is in this structure is because of this deficiency. It's as if there's a net around this body, and that net keeps this from dissolving into chaos. And that net is deficiency. So the moment this deficiency is removed or replaced by another, what happens to this body? It takes whatever deficiency it is now in the grasp of. If no other force is acting on it, there's always the universe. Take it back to chaos. So that's why they say sabbe sankhara anicchati. Sabbe sankhara dukkhati. All sankhara. Sankhara is the action again. The actions required, the energy required to bring this body together. Results in a dukkha, meaning it is a response to deficiency. And then finally, sabbe dhamma anattati. So whatever body that is the product of that work, of that sankhara, is something that is anatta, meaning it has no entity. It is not an entity. It is not an entity by nature. It is merely the aggregation to respond to a deficiency. Yada panyaya pasati. To understand that through wisdom, atha nibbidati dukkho, then you shall be free from dukkha. Esa maggo visuddhya. That is the path to liberation. Says who? Albert Einstein. But you studied him and his works. Let's be honest, the world has spent far more time studying Albert Einstein and Sir Isaac Newton than the one who said and revealed the ultimate truth and the universal truth. That is why in my eyes you stand above all of them. Yes, they have gifted mankind and humanity, technology, knowledge, but all knowledge is only required until and unless you understand this. Once you've understood this, there's no need for knowledge anymore. You know what knowledge is after all? Knowledge is knowledge about this. Just this, these bodies and how they interact with each other. That's what we call knowledge. That's why I said physics, chemistry, biology, all of it in these bodies and their interactions with each other. Wisdom is when you go to its source, to its foundations. How knowledge came into being is to be seen through wisdom. Therefore, in a world where there's ample wisdom, there needs to be little knowledge. But in a world where there's little wisdom, what will there be? Lots and lots and lots of knowledge. Where are we now? The 21st century. A world that thrives on knowledge. Meaning there's very little wisdom left. These two things are on opposite sides of the spectrum. So, have a think about what we've talked about today. Once again, I ask you, spend the next week as well. Don't see your husband. Look at your husband, but don't see him. Look at your wife, but don't see your wife. Look at your relationships, but don't see your relationships. See dukkha. Look at your car, look at your house, look at your door, look at your food, look at your cooker, look at your fridge, look at whatever. Whatever meets your eye. Look at it. Look at it. But don't see it. See this. Shall we try that? Another week? This is what you have to do for the rest of your lives. Practice. Practice this. Practice insight. Not sight. Insight. Right. Let's leave it there. Let's all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, by creating a safe and conducive environment for all to come along and listen to the Dhamma, as well as inviting the Swami to deliver the sermon, listening to it, understanding it, comprehending it, and contemplating the truths that have been uttered. Let us first and foremost transfer this message to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas throughout the world who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to the Mahanayakas, the Anunayakas of all the chapters throughout the world, as well as the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Mohanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery, and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas at Rashi the monastery. Let us also transfer this message to our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our friends, our relations, anyone and everyone who helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form, reminding ourselves that in this long journey of samsara, they will have supported us, assisted us and been of assistance whenever and we needed them. Therefore, with all these merits that we have acquired, let us transfer this to all of them. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, those who passed away in our name, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer this message to those who have lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding us that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers to us, sisters to us, friends to us, and therefore with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness towards all of them and the debt of gratitude that we all owe to them, let us transfer this message to them. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we will be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Arahatan Mahanse or an Arahatarani Mahanse in this very life itself, and in the era of this Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnan nivetnva Dvesha ginnan nivetnva
sukhayam sukhita taravetma nibbana parama sukhayam sukhita taravetma mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo nibbana parama sukhayam sukhita taravetma nibbana parama sukhayam sukhita taravetma nibbana parama sukhayam sukhita taravetma raga vini niveva dvesha gini niveva moha gini niveva nivansata leveva nivansata leveva nivansata leveva
tunduvange suvisi ananta maha guna balen සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්ත්වයන් නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් චුත්තර වෙත්වා සාදු සාදු සාදු